All right. It's finally here.
It's pretty insane. I really kind of can't believe it.
I can't believe we didn't finish this when we were doing this.
Yeah, this would have been finished a year ago. Personally, I'm glad that it's now, though, because I think we did a better job with this back half than we would have if we didn't stop there for however long we stopped. Because as we've talked about with the Thrower book, if he had also taken a little sabbatical, I think the back half of the book would be as strong as the front half.
Agreed. Yeah, he definitely... Well, I'll just say this. We are going to try to be a little bit more fair to these movies. Not saying, listen, no one's calling out Mr. Stephen Thrower.
No, God, no. We're
not doing that. It's just like, this is a mammoth task. This is a big filmmaker with a lot of work and a lot of ideas to chew on that you can't just like, you know, spit out with the rapidity of certain podcasts.
And this will be, especially today, will be good because, as our listeners know, I like SOV too much, and John sometimes likes SOV. So this should be a good middle ground conversation because Stephen Thrower clearly, as you'll notice if you read his book about all of these, starts all the reviews with how that there's no such thing as a movie shot digitally that can be good.
Yeah. I mean, that's not, yeah, that's the guy exhausted, you know, because listen, it's very hard to keep up a certain momentum, especially with this back half of Jess's career, which is littered with a lot of poop.
Yeah. You're just stepping in it. You can't dodge it. You just got to accept that there is poop on your shoes at this point in the journey. But sometimes the poop doesn't smell as bad as the others.
Yeah, it used to be blood on your shoes, but now it's poop on your shoes. And
we're going to make it hip to do deep cut Jess Franco specific jokes.
This is a tough area. And if you listen to the last episode, you can understand why, because we were trying to do our best with that. So this is not really, this episode is two things. It is not, we're not going to fangirl and try to make up our reasons why we want these to be.
Yep.
What, you know, a lot of people hope when they kind of venture into this, but we're also not here to take shots. Well, obviously some shots will be taken, but we're not here to just say this is all something that needs to be wiped away and shouldn't be wrestled with to some degree, because if you went along the journey and you care about Jess, like some of these have a lot to offer.
Yeah. And also, come on, like if you made it, I just don't understand how anyone, if they made it through like 160 of his movies and then they're like, fuck that shit. Not going to do the last 25 because video is ugly.
Yeah. Like it's
so weird to me.
And he's going to figure out his video formalities as this journey goes. So this is going to be a very interesting, this is going to be an interesting episode. And if I might be bold, none of you have the cojones to venture into this territory along with us and Mr. Stephen Thrower. So it's okay. That's why you call in the big guns for shit like this, because we are armed to the teeth. We don't venture into the unknown with a coward's heart. It's always with the Lord guiding us from within. So
that's right.
So here we are in the one shot territory of the files, the part of the Franco files that no one wants to crack open. They've gathered like a lot of dust.
Yeah, I feel like someone lost the key to that cabinet a long time ago in the office and everyone quit looking for it. Except for us. Guess what? We didn't find it, but we made our own, broke into that fucking cabinet.
Yes. And there was a family of spiders making a city in there. So
we're gonna talk about some spiders today.
Oh boy, yes we are.
Yeah.
Well, let's just get into it because It's the final one. This is bittersweet, and maybe it'll be one of two parts. We'll see how this goes. But pay attention to certain things that are going to constantly repeat themselves throughout this. And hey, it's the end of his career. He's started work now fully in the digital realm. And he's going to, I guess, remake everything. You know, like, they're always reimaginings to some degree, but it's full and full. Yeah. So we start with Tenderflesh.
Yes, and I'll be the annoying person real quick, just to remind. So technically, these first three we're going to talk about were shot on film, but they were finished and some would say brutalized digitally after the fact. And so when you watch them, you might say, there's no fucking way these were shot on film. They were for sure. You can watch some behind-the-scenes shit we'll get into as well, but... Yeah, these were shot on Super 16, though, which was pretty much new for Jess, though. He's a 35mm guy from day one, even his shorts, you know.
So. Yeah. Well, I get why people say that, because all the noticeable, discernible elements of the 16 have definitely been wiped away with digital muck.
Yeah. And I did
muck
do
right now. I'm going to be bold and take the first shot. It is muck right now. This is a man who has discovered a new type of clay or element, and he is trying to mold it, but it feels more like a child just ripping apart like something to see how the insides of it work, because I really am not sure if he's sure what he's doing.
Yeah, I don't think he is at the beginning. But just to set this up, if y'all don't know, so One Shot Productions, Tim Greaves and Kevin Collins had a magazine called One Shot Productions, and along with this dude named Hugh Gallagher. His shit is called Draculina. They had reached out to Lena Romay on the back end of them filming Killer Barbies to do an interview with her that eventually became the book, which the Lena Romay Files, Intimate Confessions of an Exhibitionist. They all became really good friends. And we're talking to Jess and Lena about how there's no way they can make movies anymore, basically, you know. And so these guys, along with another person who, God, and I'm sorry I have to say it out loud, I'm sure you love to hear it, but they also asked their buddy Peter Blumenstock, who has a record label called Cripple Dick Hot Wax, and he jumped in as well. And they started giving them money.
Yeah. Yeah, this is where I think a lot of the problems start. The problem started in Killer Barbies with the Jess handing over the reins of plot to people who want to give him money, and something he has actually never done before, but it's a new era now in the 90s. But with that, he maintained a lot of his kind of formal ambience and that strange quality that is present in all of his best work. It's not here anymore. And we are now under a producer who made movies called Gorgasm, Gorotica.
Don't forget Gore Horror.
Gore Horror.
These are movies that when I was 19 years old, was spending a lot of money at the beginning of college to try to get copies of. And that was one of my first lessons as I tumbled down the quote unquote underground gore film scene, that it wasn't always worth it. And I should wait for someone else to pay for it and let me borrow it.
Yeah. Oh boy. Because,
those movies, they're not good. Not good.
No, they're not. I've seen, Gorgasm.
It does not matter. It
doesn't matter. It was something put it on at a sleepover once, and it was like, dear Lord. So, you know, it was kind of like when friends tried to show me, what's the fucking Irish movie with the two hitmen?
Irish movies.
Ray, what's his name? Oh, well, come on. Oh, I'm.
Duck names?
Yes, I kept wanting to say the Saints of the Boondock, and I was like, that's not. Yeah, I was going to call it the Sopranos movie also, the Many Saints of Newark. I was really struggling there. Boondock Saints. That's right.
I love that that's what you jumped to, though, because that's why I didn't get it immediately, because I was thinking of, like, underground gore movies, and I was like, two dudes from dirt? What?
Well, this feels like they all gave me the same feeling of, like, insipid amateurism masquerading as, like, importance or, like, cool, something for cool punk kids.
Well, yeah, it's that, transgression without ever learning about who came before you and what it means.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. Okay, so with all that hemming and hawing, the movie is called Tender Flesh. It is a remake of The Perverse Countess.
And a little bit, there's a little bit of Eugenie in there as well. A couple other things, but mostly
a little bit. Yeah, a little bit of Eugenie in there.
It's really just the whipping scene in this one is reminiscent of, but not successful like the one in Eugenie.
No, and also because of all the whippings that have happened post Eugenie, it's like this just feels Franco-esque, but that these are kind of the very small, fleeting things of Francoism that you're going to find in this one. I really find this to be one of the worst. It's really bad.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's the people, I guess those involved are giving it what they can, you know. Michelle Bauer. Lena, of course, but this is when Michelle Bauer joins the crew, and y'all know her as the scream queen she became. Jess was just obsessed with her and with Amber Newman, because he met Amber Newman like at a fucking con, I guess. Obsessed with her, and she does her best. The only person I think who really shows up is Lena, of course, and it's fun that she plays the character Gorgon Erratic. So the Erratics are here, kind of.
Alain really Petit plays one of the Erratics. You know, finally, Alain finally back into the Jess fold.
Yep, and you get fun moments with him on the making of for this one.
Yeah,
if you check that out. But it's, for me, it's really just all we got is Anali Avars. I don't know if it was her idea for this stuff, but she goes real hard in this movie and it helps you make it through. Still not good, still not interesting, but you do at least get something that got the movie not allowed to be streamed on, or not streamed, aired on cable in the United States. So you do get something genuinely perverse that I won't even spoil. You know, watch this if you want to be a completist, otherwise don't worry about it.
Yeah, because a lot of these we're going to still give you. Okay, like the next one, I'm going to give you it's okay, but don't go in expecting brilliance. There might be two brilliant things here today, so I don't want to like get every.
I would agree. I'm excited to see if we do agree or don't.
We'll see. But there are two that really stand out. So you'll just have to wait till we uncover those. But you know, don't skip around to find out which one you think you should watch. I mean, it's important to know a lot of the things we're going to talk about. These kind of failures that lead to the more successful ones. So the next one certainly has got a lot of the Francoisms, although we'll leave it up to you, the viewer, if you think it's in any way cohesive. Marie Cookie and the Killer Tarantulas and Eight Legs to Love You. Great title.
Yeah.
But
this one opens with, I don't know, the opening I think perfectly sets the tone if you can hang with this and if you're going to get anything from it. Because one of the things we didn't have to talk about as much in the last one that's really present here is these people who decided to help pay for these movies with Jess and supposedly bring people to help with film crews and shit. Apparently no one ever learned about audio. So you can't really hear. And they did the thing because they wanted it to be released in English markets predominantly, even though you could still dub later, but whatever. They were like, nope, we're doing live sync sound. And well, it's not sync sound, it's fucking, you know, whatever. But anyway, they decided everyone had to speak English and they had to do it on set. And you really can't hear most of it. You kind of can in some scenes, but clearly no one was worrying about the audio. So the movie opens with a story of a spider that raped a woman, and then we're inside a vagina looking out as the as
Lena's like Baby Boy. It's like yeah, it's a lot like the movie Baby Boy.
That's what that was. Yeah, it's homage back and forth. They both really. Was John Singleton's a big Franco head, so.
Boy, I did think that while watching. I was like, maybe I'm gonna watch Baby Boy instead.
Yeah, so we're inside a vagina and we see Lena being born. There's a voice that is Jess's voice that I guess is the baby or the spider or Lena. I don't know.
Oh, it's her name, though. Her name, I'm yeah. sorry, I have to say, is Dame Maria von Spielberg. It's important to point that out.
Yes, it is. But yeah, so that's where the movie starts. And it's really, it looks really odd, almost in an intriguing way, enough to be, you know, like, okay, what is this movie going to be? Right. You know, that's
almost, you know, yeah, you're right. It's almost intriguing. I do agree with that.
Yeah. And that from there, then we really ramp up the Scream Queens. Cause I misspoke on the last one. Last one's just Amber Newman. Then we add Michelle Bauer.
Michelle Bauer's in this one. Yeah.
And we add Linnea Quigley. So these dudes clearly were like, Jess, do you know what a Scream Queen is? We've got them. We've got them. The ones that already are and the ones that are about to be. So yeah, it is, you know, it's fun if you dig the sort of movies those ladies are typically in to see them in Jess stuff. And they, you know, I think they honestly do a pretty decent job.
Yeah. I mean, it's Lena. This is Lena's show. She's in that big spider all web, all of, you know, the diabolical Dr. Z. She's writhing around like she's in Shining Sex, you know. And I do say, and it gets, we'll make this point also going further, especially actually with the next one. But I do appreciate how Jess shoots his aging wife as though she has not aged a day.
No, he's just as obsessed as he was in that when she's walking towards him, female vampire, all those years ago, he still sees that same exact woman and is obsessed with every single part of her. And the, you know, the performances on that web, especially Lena, but everybody when they get involved, are quite good. Periodically, they do feel a little bit like it has some of the Jess sauce. Sometimes the music and the performances do line up enough that, you know, you get that, you start to swim a little, you know, and then people talk again and it pulls you right back out of it.
But yeah.
But there are some moments in this one. So I don't think this is a failure of a film, but it's definitely, you know, we're not talking about some top tier shit here.
No. And I think like what you said, because I actually did do this when watching some of these, you're going to, and this is on you, the viewer, to do a little bit of work to maybe help, to help chase this very bitter liqueur down your throat a little bit. And that is literally like what Will just said. I got a little misty eyed at one moment thinking about her approaching that camera as the vampire and female vampire and tried to mentally push that, you know, think of that in relation to where it is now. Because when you think of it that way, a gulf of time and space opens up in your mind of just how much has passed and where we've come. And it is still, I mean, as the gap closes between now and the 90s, it's beguiling because we don't, like, the eras don't look that different sometimes. You know what I mean? Like, time is shortening. It's on a very short leash these days. And from the 70s to the 90s, it does feel like a gigantic canyon, a crater of like time. So yeah. it's emotional if you think of it that way, because this man clearly loves that old pussy still. He's like,
oh, it's just exactly the same.
Yeah. He's really not retiring that, but he doesn't have the same policy I do. Past 25 in the garbage, but he's a real man, this one.
That's so, right. That's right. A true, as we've said many times, even though they were never actually married, this is truly a wife guy.
This is such a wife guy. God, he's such a beautiful man.
It's a beautiful he really is. And now we can talk about one of the not without a charm or two, but in my opinion, one of the lower places we'll be going today, which is a bummer.
Yeah.
Considering this should be, you know, should be pretty special with all that's come before and what we know about how Jess feels about monsters.
This one hurts the most, honestly, because when you hear the plot, which Will is going to give you in just a second, you think, fuck, like, not to sound like a laser dim track there, fuck, but like, that's two people got that joke. But one's shout out to my boy Chris. But like,
show, come on,
maybe Cameron also got that. Two of my friends who listen got that anyway. This is like a plot that feels like, how did this not happen in the 70s? It's also one that doesn't feel like a retread, because it kind of sounds like a fresh idea and a fresh Frankensteinian spin on something like Vampiros Lesbos, just think of Jess doing, I mean, I know we both love this movie, Lady Frankenstein, not by Jess, but imagine Jess doing that with lesbian action between Dr. Frankenstein and the monster. I mean, sounds great. That sounds like a hell of a movie. So maybe think of it in your mind instead of watching this movie.
Yeah, there's, like I said, there's stuff, but okay. So, Dr. Frankenstein, creates this, lady monster who is a lesbian nymphomaniac, right? And that's basically where we start this thing. And that's great. As you said, that's a heroine pitch for fans of Jess, right?
There's like a lot of ideas to explore there that he hasn't done in this realm, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. And the first thing that lets us know we're in trouble is even with that pitch. So Jess himself dubs the voice of Dr. Frankenstein. Excellent. Love that. I periodically, because I've seen this one, unfortunately, multiple times. But when I was rewatching it, anytime that voice came, I just closed my eyes so I could imagine. So I could imagine Jess.
Good idea. Because what did you see instead?
Oh, instead I saw a man who goes by Carlos Subterfuge, who is a
fucking loser.
What I wrote down when I was watching yesterday was goth punk dreadlock bitch Carlos Subterfuge, and that's what's happening here. This oh my god!
No, he's like the guy that didn't get in Korn.
Yeah, because he showed up and like couldn't play an instrument, and we're like, oh, I didn't know you guys wanted to like do. I thought, okay,
yeah, they're saying, like, you got the look, but Carlos Subterfuge is somehow gayer than calling one of us monkey.
Yeah, poor Jonathan Davis was like, man, you look gayer than I am when I still do math. Like, So anyway, that's the first, like, when you see this guy, you're like, I don't know, but for, like, my stomach drops out of my ass. Even still, I know it's coming, but every time I try again, my stomach drops out of my ass.
Well, he's from Killer Barbies, we should say. He's one of the assholes from Killer Barbies.
Yes, but it's fine there because you're in this, you're hearing that shitty music. It makes sense to see a guy like this. Yeah. In this case, you're hearing this amazing pitch, and then you see that man playing Dr. fucking Frankenstein. Why couldn't he at least just been like a side bitch? Why couldn't he been Igor or something? You know?
I am like... I do wonder what the fuck was going on there. I do know, obviously, at this time, he was still trying to do one last Orloff movie. So it's which never happened. And maybe we're better off for it. Maybe we're
well,
better.
But what was going to be that Orloff movie?
We'll get to it when we...
Okay.
You can shout. Yeah, okay. But okay. This is just... yes, this is not what you want to see. And... there's even a great scene where the monster is begging to be like masturbated by Lena, Dr. Frankenstein, while they watch a man chop wood in the early 80s. Franco would have nailed that.
Yeah. And the scene is still good. Like that's still
better
a high
scene. Better scene.
Yeah. Well, cause it feels truly perverse in that especially Franco way, you know, because the way, I mean, the way, the way she's going at it on that tree, This is Michelle Bauer again, by the way, who does a great job, I think, with what she's given. But yeah, that scene is definitely a high point. The only stuff that's important to mention here, because it'll come up a lot and we can just call back to it. Oof, this is when the Ubangis, and a band who was like, man, the Killer Barbie sucks. Should we see if we can be worse?
Yeah.
Which I don't know if they are. I think they're both in league as just some of the worst shit ever. But the Ubangis are on the soundtrack here, and it's awful. They usher the song, in
the song. I just wanted just that these people belong in some sort of wood chipper. The name of the song by the Ubangis is called Psycho Punka Trashabilly.
Yeah, that's them. That's what they describe themselves as well. That's the genre.
Also, yeah, no, that's the name of somebody's like Twitter or Instagram account who takes all photos of them doing like a kind of face, you know, like a little soy, but like.
Well, you're making the. Also making the. That's the polycule face of like someone. Someone with dreadlocks who's in a polycule.
Men who say they probably love the idea of an open relationship, they love punk rock, they love black shirts and coiffing their hair up into a fucking, oh God, this upset my cat. My cat came in after he's had a sick morning. He's like, the fuck?
Yeah, so this
just
is
the worst people. And if you're one of those people out there, you don't have to tell anyone. Just change your appearance and your whole way of life.
Yeah, trust us, it'll be better. But so they usher in what really hurts. We talked about it a little with Killer Barbies, but the Ubangis are known, like all bands like that, they're known for just really on the nose shit, right? So they help usher in my opinion, things Jess is being pressured into. That's just my own projection. Whether or not it's true is up to you guys, but this group of people, I think pressuring Jess into basically leaning into the postmodern hell. So not only do we have this awful band singing these terrible songs, but we also run into a lot of shirts and posters and CDs that are just Franco ones. And so unfortunately on the walls, we have posters for his own movies. We have t-shirts. There's like a fucking, is a Necronomicon t-shirt, I think.
That's what she's wearing. Beginning.
Yeah. Yeah, and then there's even like the CD collection. I think it's like the Bruno Nicolai one.
And
it's just so sad. And I'm like, it reeks of these nerds who, again, I'm glad they gave him money and let him keep making movies, but it reeks of these nerds being like, trust me, your fans are going to lose it, man. She should be wearing this like Necronomicon shirt. And it's not good. Not good. Lust for Frankenstein is one you should save till the end.
Yeah, or kind of like what we said about that last, well, it's not the last because there's one more, but the last Red Lips movie where it's just like that we had in the previous episode where it's just like, sometimes it would have been better not to even be tantalized by the possibility of this, because like the plot of Lust for Frankenstein is really good. The plot of, I don't remember the name of that one, but the girls with red lips or something like that. And it's them meeting Al Pereira, and you're like, oh, and it's just, you know, it's like my cat this morning all over the hallway. So, so anyway.
With that, we are going to bring in.
Oh, are you ready to take an elevator down straight into a VR style hell?
Yep. Well, we're going to bring in a. Proper. Now, this is no longer shot on Super 16 and then finished on digital. This is absolutely shot on a consumer grade camera. And this is also where our buds, truly, he's a good guy, at SRS Cinema, Sub Rosa, jump in as well to help more money. Jess and Lena resurrect Manicoa Films. So this is technically a trio of companies producing this. And we have arrived, I think, what everyone's been waiting for since we started this, probably. We're at Dr. Wong's virtual hell.
Yeah, we are at Dr. Wong's virtual hell. A movie I certainly don't love, but I admire the hell out of this insane hodgepodge. I don't know. I mean, the worst part about this is obviously the dubbing. That is
hard to hear.
A lot of the dubbing of these movies is going to be the worst part. But like,
for lack of dubbing.
Or lack of dubbing. Yeah. Yeah, let's put it that way. Yeah, but like, the special effects that we kind of saw rear their ugly head in Lust for Frankenstein are really on display here. Though, because of what this is, they feel more apt.
Yep. This is, I think this is pretty.
But I'm not going to put them anywhere else on this episode. I find this to be the biggest holding back point of this career. And I'll get into why when we push on.
Yeah. This one, though, because basically, so where we're at, if you, in my opinion, if you combine a couple things, a movie that Jess has revisited a million times, not his, but The Mysterious Dr. Wong, then you combine that with his own movie, La Sombra del Judica, Contrail Dr. Wong, and then you toss in just the character, really, but you toss in Erotic Rites of Frankenstein so we can get Cagliostro, who, do you want to tell him what his name is? Because we get his first.
Yeah. What is it? It's Johnny Cagliostro? Yeah. Or Jimmy Cagliostro?
Johnny Cagliostro.
Yeah, because, boy, when you see Cagliostro start to come up, you know, I remember when I first saw this back in the day, just thinking like, oh, hell yeah. Well, it's no more than a little cutout of his face. However,
but it does make me misty-eyed, I will say.
I would agree, especially at the end, because this movie, spoiler, is dedicated to Howard Vernon. And, you know, it's telling that, I mean, obviously Jess wanted to do this Orloff film, which you could, why don't you talk about when we're done talking about Virtual Dr. Wong's Hell here, whatever the hell it's called. But it's like it hits the moment, it hits the spots, because in this desert of his career, you're looking almost for anything that you can get. So I do have to be a little rude to Jess, being like, it's like, all right, you're throwing it in there. I know why you're throwing it in there. But on the other hand, it is a beautiful, well, it's a tribute to Howard Vernon in what way he can. And we don't know the intimacies of their relationship. So it's quite possible that Jimmy Cagliostro was like a joke they had on the set of Les Gloutonniers and Erotic Rites of Frankenstein.
That joke does fit, especially in Les Gloutonniers, I think. On set, I think it's easy, because I imagine Vernon being like, I don't understand why the fuck I'm in this movie, but I'm having a blast. Should we call him Johnny?
Yeah, right. You know, it's like he probably wanted to be called Johnny Cagliostro. And, you know, I think like he's not a villain in this one. So Cagliostro in Erotic Rites is a villain, but by the time of Les Gloutonniers, it's a little more ambiguous. And by this time, he's just great guy. Like,
he's a great guy. And so we didn't really set it up. It's easy, but
he's Fu Manchu's arch nemesis, if you think about it. Because Dr. Wong in this is not just Dr. Wong from the Judoku, which you all remember as being a stellar entry in Jess's canon. But this is definitely supposed to be Fu Manchu. And clearly he couldn't use Fu Manchu at this point.
As always. Yeah.
As always. But, you know, this, well, I guess he could with Slaves of Crime.
Yeah, which also is on a television in this movie in a very funny joke, in my opinion.
Anyway, you know, that's talking about.
Yeah, you're crying. It's okay. So this is basically like where Jess is playing, of course, Dr. Wong in this beginning of the film. He's ready to kill himself. And then Lena Romay, who's playing two characters in this. When we first meet her, she's reprising her role as Tsai Ming, the daughter of Fu Manchu, or Dr. Wong, if you want. Who cares? She's also playing Nellie Smith.
The erasure of Nealon Yeah, the full-on erasure of Neyland Smith that has been progressing over the last couple of weeks.
It's so funny. But so Lena comes in and convinces him not to do it. And they make jokes. It really is fun if you care about the Fu Manchu world, because they make callback jokes to the different plots and the different things they've tried. But now it's these glasses. These glasses that make people see in virtual reality. And the best part, I think, is that when they're wearing them, they also, for whatever reason, can't really talk. So they have speech bubbles calling back to my favorite, Lucky the Inscrutable. And I do think maybe Thrower's a little lost in the sauce. I hadn't read his review of this till today. And I think maybe it's a little too much faith to suggest that Jess thought about the speech bubbles being because the glasses like cause this alchemy magic, and like people are seeing that the virtual reality is what we are seeing with the speech bubbles and shit. Maybe, but I think more Jess was just like, this will be funny, this will be cool. And I love it. I think it is funny. I do think there's a lot of good speech bubble gags.
Well, the movie's all callbacks to this stuff. So it's just like, of course he's going to call back to Lucky the Inscrutable. And then one of those Bangkok movies has the speech bubbles also. But
yeah, whatever. I forget which one.
Yeah. But, you know, so this is definitely him having fun with that. He also gets to be Dr. Wong again.
With big teeth. He wears really silly big teeth for this one.
Well, Jerry, and that does style. Yeah.
Does not help with trying to hear what the fuck anyone is saying. Yeah. And like you said, this is one of the few times I think the optical effects do really, really work in this one. But yeah, I don't know. This is a fun one if you're a huge Jess head.
And here we are at the next film, Vampire Blues.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a feeling you're going to have a lot to say on this one.
I do, but I worked really hard to make it concise.
Well, let's show the audience what you've learned.
Yeah. So this one stars Countess Irina von Murnau, which is the name of Anali Yver's character in this movie. Great name. Potentially very exciting. This is one to me that is almost the closest we get to an actual fucking real deal banger. There are a couple things that keep it from being that, in my opinion. This is, I don't know, you could put this in the realm of Macumba Sexual, sort of that kind of thing. You know, a powerful creature preying upon a woman, trying to bring her over to her side, except we're back to vampires again. So Vampiros Lesbos style as well.
It's virtually a remake of Macumba.
Yes. Absolutely. So I think this one, actually the things that keep it from truly transcending, we unfortunately have some Mori Bongi songs that are really on the nose. So that is very rough. And then the final moment of the movie also sucks. But to me, there's enough other stuff that truly we do get in the sauce, especially in the final, I would say, 13 minutes before we get the bad final scene. You get to that kind of, you know, that kind of ecstatic feeling where you start to lose your head. It's not on the level of something like Night Has a Thousand Desires, of course, but the sequence in the middle of Night that we've talked about a lot, the final sequence of this one starts to flirt with that, I think. I do. I really do. Oh my God, it gets me so high.
Mm. This is why we smoke very different things. One. And two, it flirts. It's like the way I flirt with like someone at Starbucks, if I go to a Starbucks. Like, I go in there and I'm nice and I kind of smile. That's the extent of the flirting that I'm getting to here. Because I feel what I'm getting at is I feel bad for the employees at this place. So I feel like I do this guilty thing where I always am very nice to people. And
it's better than that.
It would be better than that if not for that digital video muckery all over that crap. I agree.
Well, see, I like it in this one.
I think it's a little bit better, but it's also like if you could imagine that scene without that and just the slow-mo and kind of that hypnosis, it would be more interesting and it would show up some of the later movies that we're going to talk about that do some shit like that.
But I do think it, again, not in the whole movie, but in that final sequence I'm talking about with Lena, that also, and it harkens back to Lorne the Exorcist, which we'll talk about a lot today. But in that final scene, as truly nasty and dark as Lena is going, I do think the digital optical effects they used in that stuff does work in that scene. And the one thing we haven't mentioned that's most important, why this movie does, whether it hits for you or not, feel more like actual Jeff's, is the soundtrack outside of the Ubongi song.
Yes.
It's fucking incredible. The sound design, like, it's just full of like owls and wolves and nature again. And we get a lot of lapping water and those kinds of things that we've loved from Jeff in the past on the soundtrack.
A lot of Daniel White, culled from several of his albums on this one. So
in a really good way. I do think the sound design outside of the Ubongi stuff is pretty great. And that's really what does it, right?
You have sound.
Yeah.
I agree with you on that. I think that this is sort of a sketch for my favorite movie coming up, which can you guess what that one is?
It's absolutely the next one. Before we say the name of this, an important thing. So at this point, a guy named Pedro Timburi, I don't know how to pronounce his name, comes into the fold basically and becomes friends with Jess and Lena, and he convinces them to move to Malaga in 1997. And that's really where we start, where we're going to stick for the rest of this. So that guy's important, and we do like him, I think, more than some of the other folks who force their own ideals into these movies. This is also where we meet Ezequiel Caldas, who's quite a good performer, I think. He's not an unwelcome addition to the crew. But yeah, we've arrived at a movie called Red Lips. Red Silk.
Red Silk, you bastard.
Red Silk.
How could you do that?
Oh, God. Man, and you know me. Well, on a different episode, we'll talk about it at some point. I really can sometimes put in too much work for all the Red Lips movies because I just love that universe so much. But this one,
tough.
There's basically nothing here for me outside of, I think Ezequiel is pretty good.
Well, it's also the first one we get, what's his name? Emilio Shagorodsky? However you say that insane last name.
It's a cool name. Power name.
It's a cool name. I'm not shitting on it. It's just I'm not smart enough to pronounce it. So, he starts as the quote-unquote cinematographer, air quotes. But he's only credited as that purportedly because Jess just liked him.
Yeah, can I read that quote? Because it's interesting because we've danced around it so much. Basically, when Thrower asked him about him getting credited, he says, I worked on lots of stuff, assistant director, camera operator, but I didn't really necessarily do any of that because the way it worked is if Jess was happy with your work, he would put you in a more important place in the credits. If he respected you or had some kind of good connection with you, he would give you the main credit. I did for him some photography. It was more like suggestions, put a light here, that sort of thing. But he did everything still. It was just if he liked you, he gave you a better credit, which I love. And that's fucking sick.
Yeah. I mean, if anything, he's a man of the people.
Yep.
But he will take over eventually on a movie coming up. But
yeah, he does get more heavily involved. But this one, the only bright spot for me is that the ending made me think of We Are 18 Years Old. So going back all the way to there, but this movie's bottom five. Yeah.
I mean, just even saying that it reminds you of We Are 18 is like just trying to look back on a relationship. So you're like, it was a good moment, right? Mm-hmm. Like the time we woke up early and got donuts. You know, like that's what you have to do with this one. It's tough. It's better than, or it's not, it makes the last Red Lips that preceded this much better. And even though that's the one I would rather disappear from the face of the earth, just because of what it promises. This one is definitely should not exist on this planet.
It's really not. It's really not a movie. It's really not this.
This one doesn't hurt me like the others. The other, like,
yeah.
The other one reminds me of the first Red Lips, Kiss Me Monster, Two Undercover Angels, even stuff like, you know, we're gonna eventually talk about those movies again. I'll take this moment also to address our listeners who might not be Patreon members. If you like these episodes and you want more and you want us to go deep into stuff, or maybe you didn't agree with some of the things we said on about some of the movies on previous episodes, well, we have a very special thing for the Patreon people, and that is our Francophiles the Atonement Edition. And we are going to rethink opinions on some of the movies. So maybe you cross those off because they didn't get the John and Will thumb of approval. Well, you fucked up because we were doing too much at one point, and I for sure was way too mean to some movies. And I've looked back on it and thought, why? Probably because I had also just had an insane surgery right before that. I was not in my right mind. This was also just something that did not need to happen to run this many movies, especially of Jess, back to back. But if you want to know what these movies are that we have changed our tune on, you're going to want to go over and hit up the Patreon, and that will be there. So
that's true. With that said, let's talk about our boy Jean-Claude Carrier.
Yeah, he's technically got this a writing credit. This is based off of something kind of did. This is based off of one of our absolute favorite Jess movies, House of Lost Women. And honestly, this is not the worst of the movies we're going to talk about today. It's not the best.
I don't think it's bad. I don't think it's a bad movie. It's called Broken Dolls. Like we said, House of Lost Women. So it's basically that same plot. It's
almost virtually the same plot. Yeah.
Yeah. And you get very, you know, if you're in the Bahia Blanca kind of vibe, that I think is present here. The biggest problem for me is that, unlike House of Lost Women, this is not a transgressive movie. They do not push the things. What I do like, it's definitely bummer Jess territory. It's very melancholy. I think that some of the interstitials here are stunning. I think Jess does a really good job.
It's
with
a bummer, like Tinder. Sorry, I cut you off. No, I get too excited, and when we do this on the thing, we forget when we don't do mics, we overlap, and it's annoying. So sorry if I cut whatever Will was saying off there. Most of you probably didn't care anyway. So there's just no blood really coursing. It's bummer territory in the sense, like, kind of vibe wise of like Tinder and Perverse Emmanuel, where it's not giving you what you want necessarily, but there is this kind of melancholy aura about it.
And like very like lovely and pretty aching at times. I think this is it's a sad movie, but in a worthwhile way. I think we didn't mention her yet. Another person in the fold now, Mavi Tienda. She plays the daughter character in this one. And she to me, outside of Lena, of course, really, you know, keeps this stuff going. Cause also I think she's just really sad in life. So it comes across pretty convincingly. I do like this one, and this is one I've returned to a fair amount in my life, and I think I'll continue to, but I do wish, even if it were just the incest, man, we lose the incest from House of Lost Women, and I miss it.
Yeah. No, I mean, it just kind of makes me miss House of Lost Women more than anything, because...
Yeah, it does feel like maybe an extra chapter. Like, I don't know. Like, it's not quite as bad as I would say, like, fan fiction or something. But it does feel like another little piece, maybe, you know, if you were wandering around the island of House of Lost Women and you were like, wait, there's more island over here? I think this movie lives there.
Yeah. And if Antonio Mines could be a little fatter and...
and a Nazi.
I was going to do the Nazi salute. Yeah, then that's what you get. Okay, next one. Blind Target.
Yep. So we got a Jess really swinging for the fences here. I think doing a honest to goodness political thriller as best as he possibly can in the digital realm and getting rid of all the optical stuff, mostly.
This is way more realistic, realistically shot.
Yes, and he does, I think, an admirable job trying to make, because he does switch to better cameras at certain points throughout this journey. He's not there yet, but I think the lighting, he clearly actually spent some time trying to understand how to light digital better.
Yeah.
In a more interesting way, because this movie is lit well, and I do think this is one that if I like took the time to change the frame rate and put some grain on it, we could trick someone into thinking it was shot on film, you know?
Yeah, you probably could with this. I mean, even like the nighttime scenes look a lot better. Like the scene where she's caught by the dudes in masks that recalls Girl from Rio.
Yeah.
You know, really recalled that. And when I say in this instance that it recalled that, it brought an emotion of that movie out of me rather than reminding me of a better Jess movie. Yes. or anything like that. Radix in it again. Yep. You know, we love that man. And
this is also shocking how big the crew is for this, because they had a second unit in the United States, and because Jess and Linnea are truly buds at this point. Linnea is part of that second crew in the U.S., and so she shows up briefly in this as well. We don't need to do the plot for you. You know how Jess political thrillers go. It's a good time, and it's honestly pretty chilly as well. And Jess said in behind-the-scenes stuff that he wanted it to be very cold and that he wanted it to be like he was a journalist looking at this shit. And I think a little overdoing it, but... it is chilly in that way that I think does work. And the one thing he does, I think, let through as far as classic Jess is Lena is chewing it up playing the role of a torturer in this movie. And that is really fun.
She gets to join the ranks of Mercedes McCambridge and Howard Vernon. And she's really does feel like she kind of went into that. And that... this is probably one of my favorite Lena roles.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
As we approach the end.
I think what's most important here as well, even more so maybe than the movie, if people don't know, there's a feature length documentary that was made while they were making this movie called Antenna Criminal. That is very worthwhile. What you get to see, you see Linnea Quigley interviewing Jess and talking about his time at AIP and shit. Like, it's really fucking cool. And the best part, of course, as we get towards this tender place we're headed, you see a moment where Jess is really upset and chain smoking cigarettes, and you see Lena just console him and hold his head against her stomach, and it's so touching.
That scene alone, just that image of Jess and Lena together is heartwarming and bittersweet as we round out. And I think the documentary is cool, and you get to see the scene where the woman can't get the thing right, which I agree with Thrower. Like, why did he not just dope that?
Yeah, it's weird, and because that's what leads to the tender moment. Like, he... I don't know. I think that's where I do think maybe there's pressure from this crew that is paying for stuff for whatever reason, because none of these movies have post-dubbing, and there's no way that, because he likes to work quickly, he didn't say at some point, why can't we just do what I have always done? I feel like there's a weird pressure for it to be on set sound. I don't know.
Who knows? Well, I'll tell you, that pressure is not helping him when it comes to our next movie. Maybe my least favorite of the bunch. I think I've reached my biggest stinker.
Yeah.
Helter Skelter. Nothing about that name has anything to do with it. I mean, with most Jess movies, the name is the last thing that you really want to like worry about. But like,
there's usually a joke at least, or a wink or something. There's not here.
Tough. I just want to say briefly, so I don't think we need to spend much time on this one. It just points the way to one of the more excruciatingly bad moments that I give, that's coming up, that I actually give more props to, because it just doubles down on what kind of makes this so bad. And the one that I hadn't seen that I had made sure I asked Will for both parts of. Anyway, we'll get to that soon.
This doesn't have a plot.
That's what I mean. It starts this plot.
Yes, but I think what makes me agree, and this is also in maybe some of my most hated, is because, yes, what's happening is very rarely interesting. There's no plot, but insult to injury, there's this constant goddamn stupid fucking voiceover, pull quoting Desaad stuff that doesn't relate to anything, has nothing to do with anything, adds nothing. It's obnoxious. The narration, the voice is also stupid and annoying. All there is here at all, some of the inserts of some of the art that he shows for the interstitials could be interesting. But again, every time it is, there's more narration. All we get here that's good, Alain Petit wrote some amazing songs that he plays electric guitar on in these. Those are great. I would love to have those listened to outside of this movie, the end.
All right. And I think we're going to end it there. And we are going to do this as a two-parter. So the second part will follow soon. So stay tuned.